bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by Wired Tree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello and welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Justin Robert Young.
Hello, friends.
Brian Brushwood.
Yeah, I'm here with my co-host, Edward Furlong's hair from Terminator 2.
And Mr. Bryce Castillo. Whose hair are you sporting, Bryce?
Gosh, I don't know. It's such a mess because it's in a medium length, so it's not long yet, but it's definitely not short. I don't know.
I feel like we're definitely, even 2 years from now, let's say there's a vaccine and COVID we're not really scared of. I think there are so many men that are taking this opportunity to get over the hump, because we all have the excuse of why middle length hair looks silly on us. And then we'll be over the hump. I think long hair is going to be like, if you're looking for an entrepreneurial suggestion, invest in men's long hair. Make your own men's long hair company.
Combs for long hair.
In fact, call it
shampoo
that.
For long hair.
Yeah, because I think it's going to be a novel thing. I grew out my hair in high school, and there's some dorky phases that you go through as you get to long hair. But there's a bunch of people. Men over 20 who have never grown their hair out, who are making the decision to do so now because of you know, it's acceptable.
I know that the longer my hair grows, the more I look like Sideshow Bob.
I know that the longer my hair grows, the stronger I get.
Why have you waited so long? What are you?
I know. Yeah.
When did you not learn this?
Exactly. That was really stupid for you to have short hair your entire life.
Yeah. Geez. Gentlemen, this is my latest update on Space is Still Weird.
Oh, thank goodness.
Space. Oh, good. Good.
Still weird. So, what I love about science, and, you know, of course, you know, like the expression often, the science is never settled. Sometimes you have a pretty damn good idea. Like, that part won't change. But some things we just don't know. Remember our interstellar visitor, Oumuamua?
Yeah. That was a giant pipe, a cigar that tumbled around that looked like 2001 and was from outside of our solar system.
Yeah. So, like, we were pretty sure, and again, that's the artist rendering of what this thing looked like. I have no idea. You know, we've got like a radio signature of this thing, but it came from its orbit says, hey, this thing probably came from outside of our solar system. That's the only thing that makes sense. Great. And then there was a weird way in which it was moving, which it appeared to accelerate, which would be kind of odd because why would this thing accelerate? And there are all sorts of suggestions about this. Then one of the things that came up was like, well, maybe it's like part of a comet, and that was sort of an outgassing effect that was affecting that. And so that seemed like a pretty good kind of, you know, explanation for that was that, you know, that its wonky acceleration was due to some sort of, you know, natural phenomenon.
There's a pocket of ice in there, and now it's shooting out like a propellant, basically.
Yeah, or just one side of it, you know, one side of it is having this effect where it's sort of like, you know, causing it to radiate outwards, which is causing that effect. And that seemed to be kind of like, okay, cool. And then people were like, yeah, like it would be, I don't know, maybe it's solid, you know, it could be solid hydrogen, you know, and that would work. So I'm like, okay, we think we have.
I assume that solid hydrogen is so. In order to stay solid, it has to be so cold that even being in the far reaches of the, you know, solar effect, all of a sudden it's warm enough to start, you know, sublimating or whatever.
Yeah, well, hold on a second, Brian. I'm trying to see if I find your name on this research paper.
Wait, did I just? Oh, God dang it.
No, Brian, they don't credit you. But yes, actually, but well, but somebody else said that was the paper that was like, hey, listen, we think that this thing could be doing that. But that somebody else said, all right, Brian, et al. there's so much the heat from all that starlight out there, though. Even the starlight out there should boil the thing off.
All right.
So in your face, like, yeah, okay, Mr. Johnny Starlight affecting this thing. It's going to boil off. And so, no, it's wrong. It's alien.
That is really weird. I have no idea. Do you guys want to play a Price is Right game of what the temperature for solid hydrogen has to be? Because I would guess like 30 Kelvin.
One Kelvin.
God damn it. All right. I'm assuming Andrew already knows.
I'm looking at it right here.
Oh, so. Okay.
I mean, oh, yeah, guys, I'll play this game too.
What's your guess?
I'm going to say 14.01 degrees above absolute zero. You know,
like you just got $500. You got ding, ding, ding right on the nose.
Some researchers said, hey, we think maybe it's solid hydrogen, and then that's what's causing it. Another researcher was like, no. Even the starlight out there would cause this thing to evaporate, particularly if this thing had been out there for 40 million years. That's another thing, too, is like they've even got an idea of what part of the sky they think it formed them. The sort of like, you know, this gaseous accretion disk where maybe this thing formed of and got ejected from. And one of the things that we try to bring up a lot here in Weird Things when it comes to space is that it's not like the galaxy is static. It's not like our solar system is just hanging out here. Our solar system, since the formation of the Earth, has made like a dozen trips around the galaxy, passing other star systems and stuff. Sometimes other stars have passed straight through our solar system. And everything gets disrupted. Things are in motion. There's more data out now that there are more rogue planets than stars, meaning there are more big, giant planets out there just drifting through space. But because they're not close to a star, we don't know they're there.
I think you just blew my mind. A star passed through our solar system?
Yeah.
Inside the Oort cloud or?
They believe that there's examples where stuff like that has happened.
Wow. That's remarkable. And I guess that would be a reshuffling of all the planets, right? And so a few of them smash into each other and then reform.
Not necessarily. Okay. So here's an example from Astronomy Wandering Stars that's, God damn you, Bryce. It's fast. So for our audio listeners, I'm like typing this up and Bryce has got the article already up. Like he just.
This is a total guess on that one.
Oh, brag about it.
This is like when we find out that Bryce is an alien with superpowers. When we find out Bryce has, we're like, yeah, it was in front of us all along. Though. Like Bryce is the one who is aware of the simulation. We're at Bryce's video game simulation, and this is how he knows it. You know, this is a 1,000th trip through here.
I have to distract you from Oumuamua. So take our journey.
Bryce. Well, guys, let me. Oh, Bryce, why did you do that?
This is astronomy.com. Wandering stars pass through our solar system surprisingly often.
That's amazing.
And if it did it tomorrow, it probably wouldn't even crack the top 10 of weirdest things that's happened in 2020.
So the most famously stellar interlopers is called Schultz's star. I know nothing. The small binary star system was discovered in 2013. Its orbital path indicated about 70,000 years ago, it passed through the Oort cloud, the extended sphere of icy bodies that surrounds the fringes of our solar system.
Wow.
Some astronomers even think Schultz's star could have sent some of these objects tumbling into the inner solar system when it passed.
Wow.
But they're pretty fast and rapidly moving, so it's not like it lingers long to have too much of an impact.
I listen to all this, and I think of us as this tiny little petri dish, and it's like I remind myself that life and nature is the aberration, is the cancer on what otherwise, like, the natural order of things. Is rocks bang into each other and stars do fusion. The unnatural order of things is that life evolves. And for me, I choose life. I want to get the hell out of this petri dish. I want to infect as much of this dumb universe as we possibly can. That's terrifying.
Wait, Bryce, scroll down to the image of there, because when this thing happened 70,000 years ago, it would have been visible from Earth. And I'm gonna caption this for you here.
Wow.
What the fuck?
What the ugh?
We got this, like, you know, early human with a spear, you know, staring up at this thing going, what the hell? And I thought 0000020 was weird.
And he's looking up at this red star saying, like, I bet that's a major plot point of the book that, nope, they never mention it again. I guess dragons are something. Okay. That was a reference to the red comet.
Yeah, terrifying. Did somebody point out, at some point, our Milky Way and Andromeda are going to pass through each other, but we may just keep moving through. And, some point said, like, because stars are so diffuse, like, there may be no collisions, except perhaps with, at the center of our galaxy, we've got a big-ass black hole. And so there's a chance that that might suck some stuff into it and cause a little disruption. But, you could pass one galaxy through another one and be like, hey, what's going on? Hey, dudes, what's going on?
Wow. I guess that it would be a bit like, think of it as if you and a friend are blowing out birthday candles that are about a foot or two to the left or right of each other. Like your breaths don't, meet each other and then suddenly, cancel each other out. They just pass through each other. And then one of you blows out one birthday candle and the other one blows out the other birthday candle.
Oh, yeah, because, when our nearest star is like 3.5 light years away, that's far. That's really far. I mean, statistically, I'd be interested to see, like, what would be the probability. Even then, I think probabilistically of something colliding could be very low. But again, when you come to, like, the center with, like, the big-ass black hole there, it's like, would that cause a problem as it goes from one point to the next? I don't know. I'm just a podcaster. But as a podcaster, we depend upon your support. It's not like we can write to, like, the National Science Dudes Foundation and say, hey,
National Science Dudes,
fund us.
Can we establish the National Science Dudes Foundation?
Well, we tried, Brian. We tried writing to the National Science Dudes Foundation, and they said, sorry, dudes, you don't qualify. And that's why we had to go to patreon.com/weirdthings. It's where you can support this program. Head on over there right now. Make sure you get this Monday content as fast as possible. Any level gets the custom RSS feed. Put that in any of your podcatchers and you will get the bonus material. No passwords, no signups. It is just that simple.
So, hey, computers are really weird and they're very clever and they do interesting things. Do you remember a while ago there was somebody realized that you could make a copy of a key from a photo of a key?
Oh, yeah. Oh, I know where this is headed. I would. Oh, my gosh.
You're good. Take it, Brian. Take it.
Somebody sent me an article. Okay, so first of all, if you're a keysmith or a locksmith, you can just look at a key and say, and you see the numbers. You're like, okay, that's a 7-pin, 1-pin, 4-pin, 2-pin, and you just have to know it. And in fact, on Hacking the System, we talked about oh my God, that's Modern Rogue. So on Modern Rogue, we talked about take a photograph of a key, and Bill Duran showed us how to use a 3D printer to print out, because again, all you got to do is kind of snap it and correct it or whatever. But Andrew, if I'm not mistaken, there are other ways to sense how things are structured.
Yes, Brian, this is true. One of those ways is apparently you can use the sound of a key in a lock.
Wow.
Just the sound of it going click, 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 click. Because again, like Brian points out, keys adhere to a standard format. And so it even though if they were wildly random, it'd be different, but they're not. So what you just have to do is sort of like high click, low click, side click. Oh, okay. We know what your key is now.
So I guess it would kind of be similar to like you being able to know what phone number was dialed by back in the day where they actually made the tones. You could, just know what those tones are and know what the number was. That's a similar idea.
Yeah. Although that conceivably could be done just with your ears. I'm assuming that this solution There we go. We're looking like at a spectrograph thing that, it does look astonishingly clear when you look at it, the spectrograph of the sound.
So it's very obvious where there are clicks of each bittering, I think, goes in. And then I guess they use the frequency response to tell how high or low that spike is.
That's so amazing. Now, is this like you just need to be in the room, or is it needs to be something attached to the door to listen to directly, or?
Well, Brian, as I stall for time as I try to read this article more thoroughly to give you an intelligent answer.
Sorry, I shouldn't have asked. I should have used my I statements and said, I wonder if it just can hear it in the room or if it needs to be attached to.
So it looks like it needs audio of some sort. And I think that they describe it. It looks like just looking through this video from Hot Mobile 2020, Austin, Texas, that they do some sort of averaging also to like, it seems pretty involved. You would, but I guess once you have the audio, you have the audio.
Yeah, but you would need clean audio. I guess that's what Brian's looking for is like, can you just like hide a recorder in the plant and listen to it? Or does it need to be like a bug on the door itself, if not on the lock itself, to make sure that you're getting the cleanest possible audio?
I mean, if it's the latter now, then it certainly eventually can be the former because, you know, noise reduction and noise cleaning up
They say you can use a smartphone to record the sound.
Whoa!
Yeah, here we go. Acquiring the audio. In a walk-by attack, a spy simply walks behind someone just as they unlock a door or locker, holding their phone out to furtively record the sound of the key going to the lock. So far, we have only done this with a phone an unrealistic 10 centimeters from the lock. We are still working on making this attack realizable. The second method is hijacking the victim's smartphone so that it records and then transmits the audio over the internet.
Oh, sure, because if somebody's, you know, just walking with their phone in their left hand and their key in their right, then why wouldn't they? And they're inadvertently, I mean...
The third method might be to use an Internet of Things device that contains a microphone, like a video doorbell, which would be very close to the lock.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's an example of where if you have enough examples of audio, even imperfect audio, and you know what the key is like, you could basically use machine learning to build something that could take kind of crappy and have a high probability of getting it right.
By the way, Stoic Squirrel quotes a fairly common counterargument of like, why don't you just pick the lock? Which my response is always, well, why don't you just kick in the door? I mean, if the idea is you need to appear to be the custodian and get through as if it's no big deal, then you need to have that key already printed and you need to get that key somehow beforehand. So,
why not just knock on the door and get them to let you in, guys?
Yeah, right? Yeah. Why not ask politely? Why not ring the doorbell and say hello?
Yeah, and I think that, Brian, you're quite knowledgeable picking locks. I know a little about picking locks, and it's not always as easy as just chicka 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 chicka.
Well, certainly if you have a highly trained individual, but there's little things like, let's say you had a mission critical thing where you couldn't even allow somebody to adopt the posture. Like, for example, in order to pick a lock, you have to bend over and you have to insert two devices, one a tension wrench and then the other a pick, and you have to work your way through it. And even if you do that very, very fast, out of the corner of somebody's eye, you know what somebody picking a lock looks like versus you know what a custodian for the millionth time opening the door to get the IT whatever is looks like.
My favorite like XKCD cartoon about security, and I'm gonna get it wrong, is like, yeah, like the nerdy guy is like, I'm using like 64-bit layer crypto to protect all my documents on the laptop. And he's like imagining like the bad guys are there like, we can't get through it, 64-bit crypto, whatever. In reality, they're like, hey, hit the guy with the hammer until he gives us the password.
Yeah. I mean, I think that this kind of stuff is more fascinating in the idea of, well, how long will we believe locks are a thing that we should feel safe with? Like, is this more, does this push us more to different solutions?
To me, locks are a legal construct. If a door is unlocked and somebody walks into headquarters and walks off with our computers, then he could say, once he's arrested and found, because he will be arrested and found, he could say, I didn't know I couldn't do that. And I would have not much of a case. I would have a lesser case against him than if I bothered to put up locks, because then now, even if he picks the lock, well, it's just that, like, that shows an intent to penetrate someplace that he does not have permission to be in, because a key is implied permission. So really, all these things are symbols that help to clarify things in a court of law.
Yeah, I agree. Because, like, when you go to sleep at night in your house, we often don't just lock the door. We deadbolt it. We use a thing that on the other side of it, like, you know, you can't just unlock it. You have to, you know, do something in there. So
right.
I think that kind of shows the difference between property and personal life.
Well, and plus also remember, you can kick in a door or when, I mean, the getting one of those breaching bars, that's, you know, what, $50 on eBay. You walk up, you could get in. I mean, it makes you no more safe. It's just an insurance policy, or it's just a I don't know. Like I say, I think
it's about effort.
Illegal.
You're saying it's about effort.
No one is safe. We can all be the masses can descend upon all of us at any time and rip apart our precious lives with so much
I think
much
it's
hate.
The important reminder. The real reminder here is, guys, is never make Brian Brushwood your enemy.
Yes.
There's also a Second Amendment.
And also use his affiliate code for breaching bars on Amazon.
There's also a Second Amendment aspect to it, because if somebody just opens an unlocked door and walks in and you shoot them and they die, then you saying he was in my house, then the lawyer for the other family says, he was confused. He thought he was going into his place. But if the door is locked, even, you know, and there are locks that just happen to have you ever experienced that, where a key that didn't go to a lock happened to work on it?
I've never had that.
Oh, I full on opened up somebody else's Jeep Cherokee, Jeep Grand Cherokee, with my lock, because the keys just universally were similar enough that it slid in and opened, and I got in and I had the key in the ignition to drive away in what I thought was my car, and I looked down and I realized I was sitting on not the cheap seats but older plush brown leather seats. And I realized that I had full on walked up. My key was close enough to get the door open because the gears, the whatever, were worn down enough. Like, if they, so let's expand that metaphor and decide that maybe that could be the type of thing in a house. It was a case where my car was like two down from it, and I was coming home from Sixth Street. So, just out of the corner of the eye, everything seemed close enough. So now you're doing that, which is why, as Andrew was saying, we deadbolt before we go to bed. Because now if somebody's inside your house and you know you've deadbolted it and you shoot them dead, that's a much different story than even locking it. And certainly a much, much different story than leaving the door unlocked.
See the story in the chat room?
No, I missed it.
It's pretty funny.
What is it?
Yeah, JV Phobic says, I worked at a semi dealership. We found out after a month or so that our loaner was the same key as an employee's. His car was used multiple times without him knowing it during the day.
Oh, wow.
When did I go to Wendy's? Huh. Gosh.
That's crazy. I didn't even know that was possible. Like, I didn't know that was a thing. That's crazy.
No. Nobody's safe. I sent Bryce a video or link to one of my favorite, I've mentioned this before, 2 Minute Papers. It's just a wonderful YouTube series about AI, developments in it. You know, a couple times a week, he puts up new videos about different stuff. And this is really kind of crazy because what it is, it's being able to take very like abstract images and like render video footage from it. So if you play this, like
we're looking at a clip here.
Yeah, go, Bryce.
We're looking at a clip here of it looks like a dash cam of a car driving down the street.
Oh,
Brian.
My gosh. Yeah. And so if I'm guessing where this is headed, first of all, it looks like just straight up dash cam footage. I would have believed it out of the corner of my eye outside of like those trees are very blendy and there's a little bit of mushiness. But now it shows it next to just like a purple blob and a blue blob and some green blobs. And then it just changes all of that into virtually. I'm not going to call it realistic or movie quality or whatever. But wow, it makes it into a real video. It looks like a dash cam.
Yeah, he referenced there was like, remember an AI was able to make Pac-Man by watching Pac-Man. It was able to figure out the rules of Pac-Man by watching enough. And you can take the same thing. What they did is they took the just color blob, like this is a car, just a, you know, outline of a car. This is street. This is like four colors to sort of define stuff. Took that and used a system that trained on a ton of data on what cars were and streets were. And then it was able to procedurally generate this. And what this new paper does is cool is it has memory, because that's one of the problems with some of these things is it won't remember 800 frames later what was at the original point, because it doesn't really know that it came back to this. This new paper shows the ability to remember where it came from. And they just showed this clip of where, you know, when people do the video where everybody freezes and the camera moves around.
Yeah, yeah.
In early examples, like the camera would come back on a person, their shirt would change. And this new one, the shirt is the same because the AI goes, oh, we're back to where we started.
It has a wow. what neurologists, what a persistence of vision, persistence of memory.
Memory?
Like
So, and a sense of spatial memory, too. It understands that it's not just this follows. This is like, oh, this is based on this other thing here. So very cool, very creepy, very fascinating. But we're getting to the point where you could take a book, tell an AI what your characters look like and say, oh yeah. And, you know, use David Fincher style and it would be able to start generating. At first it's going to look, we'll be like, oh, and first we'll be like, oh, this looks like garbage, but then it will not.
Yeah. Well, and keep in mind, once it's made that movie and gotten, you know, little nudges here or there, and it's like, oh, fix this, tweak that, too much, too little, do this, do that. If there's a unified database that knows all of those things, now it's just going to be even better the next time it does it.
Well, and, you know, procedurally generated content, we've talked about this a lot, and a full disclosure, I'm working with OpenAI on some projects, not relating to this, but in general on their API. You're seeing that and other text generators like we played with before, like having it generate like fake podcast episodes and stuff. We're not that too many generations removed from, we just feed it the stories that I fed it and it consuming, God, how many hours we've had of this show. And it could do a version of our show that would be indistinguishable from what we do. Probably better.
Well, unfortunately, I'm thinking of all the artifacts that it would make sure to put in there, like me stammering and cutting you off and ruining bits beforehand, and Andrew's kind but exasperated sigh as he says, "Well, way to cut to the end, Brian."
No, I like it. I love those. I love watching you put two and two together. That is the fun part for me.
It does help that you're setting up the bit and you're taking me 99% of the way
Well, but I mean, aside of it's like I think that from what we started with, what we consume outside, we've done so many stories and so many weird things about different stuff. Like my favorite example was the cave. And the footprints were on the ceiling. And Brian's like, oh, maybe it was mud that receded away. Damn it, Brian.
Nailed it.
There's some guy somewhere who spent 3 years staring at this footprint on the ceiling, you know.
Man. Let me ask you guys on an emotional level, how cool are you with all of this? With all of this eventually becoming as perfect as a Michael Crichton novel would have predicted 30 years ago or whatever.
I mean, we know. Yeah, we know which side Andrew's picked.
I've been working with OpenAI, and the reason I've been doing that is that I want to help get tools out there for creatives and other people so everybody can benefit and use this technology. That is my goal. I think this stuff is powerful. It's amazing. When I got to work with the API that we talked a bit about, I had an amazing experience. I was able to do really cool things, could see the limitations, but could see the directions going. And a little light bulb clicked on my head is I want to help other people outside of machine learning AI learn how to use this stuff. I want to help make tools to make it easier for other people to use this. And so that's why, you know, when OpenAI said, do you want to work with us on some stuff? I'm like, I'd love to, because this is my goal is this stuff is powerful. Whether it comes from whoever it comes from, it's going to be transformative, and better that we're thinking now how to make it accessible than later on.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that specifically through where we are right now with AI, the immediate future is more how it's going to be used as a tool for creatives. I think the idea of enter a thing, it spits out a perfect version of, like, you know, a movie. You put in a book and it spits out a perfect movie version is a little bit in the offing. And what's going to get us there is more the idea of people taking AI and using it to build better art, you know, human curated use of AI to go forward. And I think that's something that will be very exciting. It will be a gigantic leap forward in the way that, you know, being able to use a digital calculator was, you know.
Well, I want to hear your point, but I will give you an example. Using what Justin's doing with Raise the Dead, I see, because the first thing the AI is going to be is, like, it's going to be good tools to help you do the thing you want to do better, because it's still, at this point, it still can't do some of the really hard creative stuff. I could see where Justin can say, okay, here's my script for Raise the Dead. Send it to an AI that says, okay, this is a cool point. You could approve this, work on this because this is your style you like. Goes to there, records his podcast, and then an AI that works on voice stuff, whatever, said, hey, I corrected the couple times where you stuttered or whatever, and I smoothed that over. Then say, okay, I want to make the YouTube. I want to make the video of it. And it says, great, I've pulled up a bunch of footage and stuff, and what I can't get the rights to, I've generated footage at the 1960 convention. Yeah. You know, I've generated this stuff. And then Justin can say, great, I can now produce the audio and a video documentary on this using these tools. So all of a sudden, his thinking is amplified tremendously.
So picture this. Picture getting to a point where educators are able to use these tools and say, I need you to explain how mitochondria works using metaphors in the style of a Marvel superhero action movie. It needs to be, and then a slider bar. Is this a 5-minute YouTube vignette where you have to overly simplify things? Or is this a 30-minute in-depth thing where you start adding characters to represent different chemical reactions? Or is this a Ken Burns style 10-hour documentary in which we start with where it came from, how it evolved, what it's good for, why it was kept around, what the precedents were, what the effects are, what might be possible. And now, and all of that, if, like, we're talking about the ability to matrix style by translating into high fidelity stories, information, where you just download modules. We already have a proto version of that with YouTube, where it's like, if you want to know how to change a carburetor, you load up the 5-minute YouTube, and there's a 5-minute version made by a human, a 30-minute version made by a human that explains a little bit more about it, or a series about carburetors. Just all of that done by computers so that you can keep the young minds engaged. Oh, and that's the other thing. You could have a slider bar on, this is great. Unfortunately, this is great for a 7-year-old. I need you to punch it up and make it more interesting for a 17-year-old. So you slide it over to 17-year-old. So there's like a sex subplot and there's 3 F-bombs. And then, but it's still explaining how mitochondria works at the end of the day.
So I didn't fine tune. I didn't do any sort of tuning on that. So let me give you an example. I did one, because I think you can adjust temperature and all that whatever to make things different work. So one of the things I did is I said, look, my 10-year-old asked me to explain how a mitochondria works using Marvel Comics references. The mitochondria is like the Hulk. It's a big green guy, like smash thing. It's a powerhouse. It's the powerhouse of the cell. It's a, you know,
Is this OpenAI right now?
This is the playground. Yeah.
Oh, that's so amazing. Like, and so like, really, it's just a matter of engineering fidelity to actually show it and tell it. And in the voice of Stan Lee and with the licensed likeness of the Marvel characters.
Yeah, it's the ability that it has to understand sort of metaphors and to like speak in that way is really incredible. And I've seen examples of like,
as
you know,
incredible
Twitter.
Never mind.
Yeah, the word incredible, I guess. I can't think of any reference.
Screw you.
Yeah. So anyhow, yeah, it's very good at using analogies like that. And as is right now, but like you said, that's a first step towards something else. And I think that's really, really a thing I want people to focus on is the idea of, and think about how would you use this to help do what you're doing? What kind of work do you not want to do that you wanted to do? And some people are trying to use it for just pure, I wanted to tell me stories, and it'll get there. But right now it's like, I wanted to help me tell better stories. I want to help me tell stories in different mediums.
That's the biggest thing, especially with something like Raise the Dead. When you're looking at the project, you really don't know. All of our histories have been curated as kind of final drafts, right? And even stuff from the era, stuff afterward. It is a modern idea, and one I think really shaped by the internet, that we are looking for the whole story and not the real story or the story that you need to know. And that is like just a fundamental a refocusing of how we think of stuff. And so it makes it very hard when you're going back and researching that there's no master list of just, hey, what's everything that happened? What's every book that's ever been written on this? What's every piece of firsthand data? And that stuff that's here, like based on what OpenAI is doing and what I've seen firsthand, we're like the engine is there. It needs to be fine-tuned to do what I want it to do, but that's here now. And that's like a researcher's, that used to be a team of three for a year, you know, like, and now it can be done in 15 seconds.
Well, and so think about this. Now all of a sudden I'm thinking of it as a time travel machine that reveals a hidden history that we didn't know was there, because many parts of history we know because there was one defining, well-written or particularly well-distributed piece of storytelling that was associated with that moment. But meanwhile, there are thousands of fragments and pieces that that were not widely distributed, or but were maybe closer to the source or whatever. So, of course, you know, NPR is full of the hidden history behind stories. And what, as you mentioned, Justin, people have to do is go and find those scraps that weren't popular enough to survive and become well-known today. A computer has all the time in the world, and the more of history that we feed it, the more an AI would be able to say, hey, tell us what happened at this event. And it takes the very popular, very well-known account and holds it up right next to and along with all the fragments that are very tedious, incomplete, non-poetic, and then running its AI game says, this dude threw the first punch, and it was definitely this other guy that is guilty of the thing, or most likely to be guilty of the thing, and that, and you know, nobody with a symmetrical chiseled face who happened to be one race or another affected the decision. It's statistically most likely that this is, and then it can make a movie of that moment as it more likely occurred than we know it as.
It's exciting to think about what happens when you're able to take a lot of data and connect it to other things. You know, like we know a lot about like Roman life because the Romans documented stuff and we could still find the remnants of their forts and things like this. But when you start extending outward, we talked about this on a previous episode of like, you know, in the Americas, particularly in South America, where a lot of stuff was built in jungles environments where things, anything not made out of stone didn't last. And it's one of the problems of archaeology is often that stone stuff, we go, ah, look, they built with stone, but we don't pay a lot of attention to what people built with wood in a lot of cases because the wood didn't last. And, but you could start to sort of extrapolate from like, oh, we know that a group like this would probably need this many calories per day. So they need to be getting their calories from somewhere, which means that maybe there was either going to be crops or something or whatever. And you could start extrapolating from that and using other examples and like filling in the blank spots of what we know about other things. But then you get geology where you could be like, yeah, no, we think there had to be like a lake that fed, you know, a farmland somewhere here in Peru. And now let's go dig in this likely spot where it could be like, oh, lo and behold, our model said there should be something here. And now we found it.
And it's tempting at this point to say, well, I mean, models are just models. And it's like, hey, dude, models got us to the moon. You know, like yeah, models can be pretty reliable.
And that's the thing with that example is the idea is using it to give you an example of then where to dig, you know, to say, how do we verify this? How do we prove this? And I think there's going to be cases where we're going to say like, oh, no, according to this, there should be something here. You know, one of the things that's been neat is a lot of NASA's released some of the footage and, you know, some of the films from our photographs from like the Corona Project, which was our first like spy satellite project, right? Because things change over time. And then we've had some stuff from like World War II. We were able to look at like Alexandria and other cities and stuff, you know, before the big buildup of aerial photography of places like this. And then we're seeing stuff of like parts of the Silk Road caravan routes. In some places it goes away, but you're like, well, we know it was here and we know it was here. There's something between the two spots. There might also have been some small cities there too. So now we have an idea where to look.
Man, and then you start getting into, even if there's no remnants left of, let's say, the Silk Road or whatever, you have a beginning point, an end point, and then you can feed it all the topology in between. And all of a sudden it's like, well, if you had thousands of generations to figure out how to get from point A to point B, this is definitely the shortest, easiest route. And it would make a lot of sense for this to have been it. And then now you know where to look and go poking around for more data, confirming data.
Yeah, and things like the spread of genes, you know, and also some of the, like, we still historically, like bubonic plague and things like this, we have an idea of where these things may have came from, but we're not quite sure. But then all of a sudden, once you establish trade routes and stuff, you start, yeah, holistically, you can put together a much bigger picture of the past.
Well, and now I'm back to the fragments or whatever, because a phrase that is on a slip of paper in one area that you think is totally unrelated to the bubonic plague. Suddenly, if you know if you figure out the trade routes, the likely routes, and you figure out the type of people who would trade and the timing and all that stuff, then all of a sudden the most casual tiny slip of paper becomes more confirming evidence of like, per the way language worked at the time, this phrase would be the way somebody would express, I saw a dark boil on somebody's face. He was gross and made a pass at me. And here's the reason that even though this town was never affected by bubonic plague, it really does. The more you can hold in your bucket, it's a giant snowball effect.
One of the ways we try to date stuff too is we'll look at when this culture recorded certain astronomical events, then we might go look at the Chinese history of that. Cause like, you know, Chinese astronomers were recording comets and things for a long time. And you find like, oh, you know, the Vikings talked about this event with such and such, but we know in the year 426 in, you know, China, they recorded the same sort of event. That means this probably, you know, came from the same time period. So.
Man, the idea of everything going in one big bucket and stuff becoming more obvious it's terrifying and exciting and crazy. And there are deep, both political and humanistic ramifications to it in terms of, who owns that information and that data and that synthesis, that ability to combine two facts, you know,
completely unrelated. Guys, go watch Devs.
I didn't want to bring it up again, but that's really what we're teasing around is Devs is some real, it's happening. It's really happening.
Bryce hates
Devs. No, he doesn't. No, he doesn't. He thinks it's fine.
Bryce
it's,
hates
it's
Devs.
Fine. Oh,
he hates it, it's though. Fine.
It's
man. I don't want to welcome that kind of hate in my heart the way Bryce hates Devs.
Let's do some picks here.
You know what? I'll double down on my pick from earlier, the Rebel DV Guide, the DV Rebels Guide. It's a foundational book that is very, very easy to read. I don't know how dated it is in terms of the equipment, but the fundamentals of just understanding, if you want to learn in a world where we're all shooting from home, you should learn how to light a shot, compose a shot. You should learn how to pace things. You should learn just how to run and gun. It's very simple stuff. It's very easy. There's lots of pictures, and it's like you'll read it and you'll say, oh, I get it now. I can make good video.
So it's by Stu Mashwitz, and he's also done some cool stuff. He wrote some software called Slugline, which is a really cool software for like if you want to like write scripts and stuff. It's very intuitive. And I think I know him because I think the first time I ever encountered Stu, who wrote that, was he was inquiring about the rights to my book Public Enemy Zero years ago.
No kidding. That's wonderful.
Wow.
How cool. Yeah.
But yeah, Slugline, I don't know if they have a new version or they're doing it, but that's really cool. So like he's a guy that's kept active in creating cool tools and other stuff too.
I watched episode one of a documentary last night called The Vow. It is about Nixium, the company that was eventually revealed to be a little bit more of a cult, and the leaders for which, including a few very famous actresses or television actresses, were kind of revealed to be running a sex trafficking ring, effectively. It was good. I liked the documentary. They are slow playing it. We're kind of getting into this era of these documentary series where, you know, look, I don't know how many episodes this thing's going to be, but boy, do they get deliberate about how long they want to stretch stuff out. But I do feel that the first episode was very affecting for me because having read about Scientology and certain other cults and stuff like that, I've always understood how people could fall in, but I've never really been able to connect specific elements of you know, those organizations to people that I have known. But you know, we've all spent time in the organized skepticism field. And we all know that there is, of course, a great benefit to understanding and being more into a critical thinking perspective. We also know that that is not the cure to all of life's ills. And sometimes people become more frustrated when they are living in a rational space, a critical thinking space. And boy, howdy, could I see people from that. They don't spell it out in this episode that there was an element of the either skeptic or atheist crowd that was more specifically primed to fall in to the Nixium crowd. But man, did I recognize personalities that I have seen in some of the areas that we have all kind of frequented through. And boy, did it really run a chill down my spine.
It sounds like you're, I don't want to say tap dancing, but delicately expressing the sentiment that much like in the 70s, scientists perceived that they couldn't possibly fall for a simple magic trick. There's an essence of it. Some skeptical folks would perceive that they couldn't possibly fall into a cult.
And it's designed very deliberately where this is not magic. And this is not everything is it's because it's just this new science that this brilliant man has created. And boy, are there charts and are there like all these different ways that you cannot feel like you're an idiot for spending X amount of money to go to this self-help thing. It's a lot of the same tenets of Scientology, you know, in terms of the psychology of it, of breaking down barriers in front of other people, and therefore you feel very connected to everybody. But like, this is not because they have a magic machine. It's because there is just a way that this very, very smart man, Vanguard, has figured out the way that the human brain works and has indeed cracked, and this is what the first episode goes into, the science of joy.
You know, one of the things that frustrated me a lot when I worked in a skeptical community was that, and this was sort of a bias of skeptics would be, they would go like, why do people hate science? They'd be like, we got to combat people. We have to fight all this anti-science, you know, mentality. People hate science. And I'm like, and I'm the one person in the room going, again, it's my memory, maybe wrong, but I'm like, people don't hate science. People love science. Even the most pseudoscientific thing that you hate, astrologers or whatever, will claim that it's scientific. People love science. They love the idea of science. That's why they try to drape science around it. They're not there like, oh, these stupid scientists, let's burn them. No, they just don't understand what is and what isn't. And that was a frustrating thing for me because it was this weird tribalism, like, oh, well, they hate science. I'm like, no, they like it. They just, you're conflating somebody disagreeing with you with disagreeing with science. And that's a very different thing. And if you frame your argument like, well, how do we get them to like science? Problem solved. They all do. They just don't know what is and what isn't.
Yeah. But I'm excited to get further into the documentary. It's I know from what I know of the story, we did not even scratch the surface of some of the stuff that went on. So The Vow on HBO.
I involuntarily gasped when you said watch the first episode of a documentary series, because last night Netflix did one of those shove it in your face trailers, and I clicked on it, and it's for the documentary series High Score. I really enjoyed the first episode.
I watched two episodes of that. Yeah, I thought it was good.
Yeah, very good production values on that.
I got to pick. This is something that I picked about 3 weeks ago. And then a few days after we did that recording, that pick became invalid because it shut down very briefly. But it's back, baby. Play ball. Baseball is back, y'all.
Yeah. Why did it shut down?
They took it down for 2 weeks because
there was a lawsuit from the Los Angeles
Baseball league.
The Los Angeles cup fillers are waitresses.
Well, it was the LA tacos, but now they're the unlimited tacos because baseball, if you didn't hear, it's a online baseball league. You can bet, it's free, you can bet coins, and they simulate games every hour. So every team plays a game every hour. So like, we've got the results from the game that just wrapped up for this 2 p.m. Score here. And so you pick a team that's your like favored team. And then Monday through Friday, they play a game pretty much 24 hours until they hit 100 games. And then on Saturday is the postseason. And what is really interesting about baseball is that it's two things, right? It's like, here's like a faux sports. It's a sports betting game, but it's free. If you run out of coins, they'll give you coins. There's no paid transaction going on. And then there's like a collaborative lore element. So if you get into the Discord, or if you go on Twitter and you see all the fan art and you see all of the backstories that everyone is making for the characters, and there's a team, the Seattle Garages, who have put together multiple EPs of fan written music about the game, about the players, all sorts of really good stuff. Everyone comes up with chants for their team. And so you go into the Discord, and when a game really pops off, when it goes into overtime, into extra innings, you just have that endorphin rush. It's just like, it's it's a rush is a big way to describe it, because every hour, new set of games, you know, check the stats, check the lineups, and then bet, and then it's a really dangerous cycle.
I would imagine it's the kind of thing that you start off like faux cheering live, and then at some point you realize, oh no, I'm unironically cheering.
Yeah.
And so is everybody else.
Yeah. I think on that last season that they did before they shut down for a few weeks, I think I even booted up our Twitch channel here and like was calling one of the games during the finals.
You're calling one of the games.
I was calling the games, yeah. Which was fun. And I'd like to do that more now that
it's
back.
You know, it's really, really funny because there are some sports now that I love, and at one point in my life I watched very closely, that I almost totally interact with now via Reddit and podcasts. I don't watch them all that much. Like I catch them when I can, but the life, my fandom is in these ancillary worlds. And I think that's a super cool idea to say, what if the sport really didn't exist and you were just random number generating, mm-hmm. and you were even doing it on a way where things were more compressed. So all the ancillary stuff was just the point. That is the point of it. Is the reaction.
It's number one. You're right, Andrew.
Yeah.
And so we're in season four. This is the season of feedback. So last season before they shut down, the community voted. There's also a voting element, so you can vote to benefit your team or to unlock things for the community. One of the things that was unlocked was interviews. And so now when you go to you used to only be able to see the lineups and the star ratings, but now you can click into people and see like more specific stats. You can see what their pregame ritual is. So York Silk here on the Fridays, he likes to LARP before the game, what style of coffee they like, their blood type, their soul screen.
Blood type is grass. I love that they lean into the ridiculous on this.
Yeah. You know, like they have a rule book and it's all like blanked out like an SCP sort of thing. So it's a lot of fun. And I think it's also something where by virtue of being free and by the community being very family-friendly, like even the Discord server that they're in, there's like no cussing allowed. They have a bot that will detect it and kick you the heck out. And so it's very approachable. And I think I was upset that they took those 2 weeks off right at kind of a height, you know, their peak of interest, all these news articles about it and all sorts of Twitter people getting interested in it. But, you know, using it a little bit now that the season
it was
started.
A server thing though, right? They needed to tune the server because wasn't it going down?
Yeah, it was a combination of things. There was hacking going on. The servers were getting overloaded quite a bit. There were a lot of quality of life things that they could not that they needed time to figure out. Like they've revamped like the even little things like the betting window now, like is. This used to be like a drop-down box, and it used to be really confusing who you were betting for. And little things that when you're also maintaining a 6-day-a-week live game become very difficult. So I actually think like that they actually had really good dividends. So blazeball.com, I think it's really cool. Andrew, you got a pick?
I do have a pick. I saw a thing, this was announced months ago, and then it just popped up on YouTube, and I watched it. It was an hour and a half long, and I loved it. I had no idea how much I would love it. And this is, get the name right, Live from the Space Stage, a Halix story. And I think we may have talked about this before. Halix was a band that Disney Music created back in 1981. It was supposed to be kind of the idea was sort of a Star Wars meets Kiss, because Disney Music label, which had done like the disco Mickey stuff, wanted to try to create a more, you know, wider appeal band. And so they created this rock band and basically tried them out at the Tomorrowland, at the Tomorrowland stage below Space Mountain one summer in 1981. And by the end of the summer, the goal is to showcase them, get them practice, whatever. And things like they had like a Chewbacca like dude playing bass guitar. Okay. They had like this robot synthesizer dude who looked like a stormtrooper, you know, in this built in synthesizer. They had an amphibian dude playing percussion, and they had a great lead singer. And so they were there for one summer, and then they got a deal with Warner Brother Music, but then that folded, and then it sort of, you know, there's more to the story what happened, but it is a really good documentary, really well done. And it is it was produced by Defunctland, which does the wonderful sort of stuff on Disney. And there were people who had fond memories of 1981 of going to see Helix, because the thing was, the band was good. The band was actually good. And that was sort of the surprise, was it's 1981, you know, pop rock kind of music, but it was actually way better. Should have, they had one of the people helping do music was Mike Post, the guy who did theme songs for like Doogie Howser, Law and Order, and a ton of stuff. So the skill and the talent, it was Disney doing a great job of making a thing, but then what happened to it? And that this documentary gets into what happened. The really emotional, touching, I think it's Michael Serrano, the guy who did this, first time ever doing a documentary, his first time directing anything, and knocked it out of the park. It is good or better than many of the things you'll see on Netflix or Disney Plus or whatever. It's free. It's free. You can watch this thing for free.
On the Defunctland channel or where?
Yep. It's on the Defunctland channel.
Oh, that's so great. I'm so excited. This is an instant must watch.
Yeah. I was curious because at first I'm like, I never heard of Helix, although I was in California at that time, and I will convince myself at some point that I saw them live. it was, you're like, oh, what a goofy thing to do. And then you hear some of the music, like, oh, this is actually pretty good. And you see the stage show, you're like, and I want to do this. And they talked about how they had teenagers that kept coming back night after night to see them, you know, and kept doing it because, like, the lead singer was phenomenal, and there was just a great, talented band. And I hope to God Disney brings this back. Disney, you've got a gold mine here. You've got this. I've actually asked a friend at Disney who knows some of the people in music, like, could you check in to see if these albums are actually lost? You know, could you maybe see?
I could vouch for people coming back night after night, like during Halloween Horror Nights, people would, you know, you buy a season pass, you go every single night. Yeah. And it's like, I would feel guilty because I would see the same faces show after show. And a friend of mine reminded me, like, hey man, every time I play Star Wars, I don't expect it to be different. I put it in for a reason, you know?
Yeah. Yep. So it's like, yeah, and that's, you know, for many, many teen, you know, many young teens or tweens, this was their first exposure to any kind of rock concert kind of thing or anything like that. And I'm curious to see your reactions on this, because I hope we can talk about it next week to see. But I loved the way this was done. I mean, overall, the effect of what they did. And I thought for somebody who, as far as I know, had never directed a documentary to come in and make this thing, and just in Defunctland, hats off to Kevin Perger and Defunctland, which is one of the best YouTube channels bar none, just yep. the quality of the full content. Stop. Yeah. We're in a golden age where, like, I like the Netflix series, what I've seen, High Score. I think that's really well done. But what I'm watching people do with just a small team of people doing music and other stuff, what I'm watching two or three person teams do on YouTube is phenomenal. And I remember having, you know, Justin and I worked, you know, we did documentaries for G4, and we kind of could understand it, where the enemy wasn't our creativity or lack thereof. The enemy was the environment in which you're trying to create stuff in there. You know, had we got to do the show we wanted to do, you would have had a in-depth documentary on Elon Musk in 2008. You know, you would have had a thing that really went into, like, you know, esports and stuff, the darker side. You know, we could have done so much more stuff, but.
Yep.
No. And so it's amazing. And
again, just major hats off to everyone on the Defunctland team. I'm so excited. Yeah. I'm so stoked.
Yeah. So, good job. Gentlemen, it's been weird.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.